Okay, so I want to start this evening by sort of correcting something I said last week, or at least not quite correcting it, but this is one of the interesting things about doing Likon Week in seminars. You can disagree with yourself. And you can say, what are you talking about? You can disagree with yourself last week, which is quite pleasant, really. I probably disagree with myself next week as well. So one of the main things I was saying last week was that the stage of spiritual death isn't really a stage, it's a decision. I never thought that before until I said it. They're often my best thoughts when I find them, discover them. So the stage of spiritual life isn't a stage so much as a decision. And it's a decision to commit yourself. And I really wanted to emphasize that commitment. Because it's commitment that makes spiritual life a serious matter. Until we commit to something, to anything really, whether it's playing the piano, learning Spanish, watercolor painting, you name it, math proof. Until we commit to, just to show I can be broad, as soon as we commit to something, that's when it becomes serious, isn't it? Until then, you're kind of playing. You know, like where you can start to paint and it's really enjoyable when you first start to paint. It's really sort of pleasurable and you find that you can do lots of stuff, da da da. But as soon as you think, actually, I want to really make something of this, then it gets serious. And actually, very often your pleasure sort of goes down, and you sort of know that. You know that, actually, if I'm going to go any further with this, actually I need to commit myself to it. I'm enjoying it. It's a bit like when you play tennis. You remember that time when you're just playing it, and you're doing a friendly, and just hitting it over the net. And at first it's just great to get over the net, but then eventually you just think, look, I'm either going to try and learn to play tennis and do serving and all that kind of thing, and backhands, or it's going to get boring. Do you know what I mean? I think it really is like that. That if you want to go anywhere further in life with anything, you have to commit yourself. And to commit yourself to one thing is not to commit yourself to another, very often. Or at least not many of things. You can't decide you want to be a concert pianist and a great tennis player and a wonderful mathematician. Such things sort of exist, but they're extraordinarily rare. In fact, I can't think of anyone. Now, this general principle of commitment is even more true in spiritual life. It's only when you commit yourself to spiritual life that it becomes serious in this kind of grown-up sense. It's only then that it really becomes serious. In a way, it's only then that it really becomes a spiritual life. Until then, it's at best, it's a very good human life that we're living. One of the things I experienced when I first came to the centre was, suddenly I was in a community of people that I could be myself with. I could be very open about myself. I liked people I met. I felt welcome. I felt I could contribute actually very quickly. I kind of related to people. I quite quickly felt a lot happier. But there was a point in which, even though, I remember, I think I've said it already in the seminar, that there was a point where I was really in a very happy place, and I suddenly realised that I was going to ask for ordination. And I realised it in the moment while I was telling people why I wasn't going to ask for ordination. I don't know whether you've ever experienced it. Very often when I say I'm not going to do something, that means I'm going to do something. My first solitary retreat I went on to, my idea was to decide whether to ask for ordination or to go back to art school to do my MA. I was 2 weeks, and at the end of it, I thought, right, here's your chance, think about it. Weighed up the pros and cons, decided definitely I would go back and do my art MA. I wouldn't ask for ordination. And I got back and asked for ordination. I just said, hang on, that wasn't what I meant at all. I think that's actually quite important, quite instructive. what I was trying to say last week is that spiritual life really begins in earnest when you commit yourself to it. And you're always committing yourself to the unknown. There's no commitment to the known. That's even true in painting. When you commit yourself to painting, which I did at one point, you don't know what it means. You just got this idea that you're going to have this lovely moment with a paintbrush, that you're just going to look at trees. You don't realise how much agony is involved. You don't realise the sheer mess of it. You don't realise the difficulty of it to do something well. Do you see what I mean? It's only when you commit yourself to painting that you really realise what it entails. And then when you realise what it's entailed a bit, you see how much further you could go. And then when you get towards that, you see how much further it is to go. It makes painting or any life deeply fulfilling, but also strangely provoking, disturbing. I was just writing just the other day about a time when Cézanne was painting on this a picture of some still life in his studio. He was working on it for weeks. He used to work agonisingly slowly, apparently, and for weeks and weeks and then. And then eventually got so fed up with his painting, he just flung it out the studio window in a rage. He used to destroy them. And his studio was upstairs, so it landed in an apple tree. And then, when he finally calmed down, he had the embarrassment of having to go and ask his son if he would get a pole and knock this painting down so he could carry on with it. Yeah. But when you commit yourself to painting, you don't think you're going to get into the, flinging it out of the window moment. But you do. If you commit yourself to it, you do. And if you don't, you've not committed yourself to it in a certain sort of way. It comes to matter in a new way, which you couldn't have known when you were just playing around with paint. You couldn't have known how much it would come to matter to you. Do you see what I mean? You can sort of see what other people have done, but you never know what it would do to you. So that's what I mean by you commit yourself always to the unknown. You never know what will happen from that commitment. Yeah. But what I wanted to sort of correct about that just now is you don't ask for ordination because you're ready to be ordained. You ask for ordination for no reason. What was thinking back on my own experience, I was just thinking, well, hang on, what happened to me? I certainly didn't think, oh, I'm ready to be ordained, but I'm not even particularly sure. I thought I want to be ordained. Not that I want to be ordained. What was it anyway? You know what I mean? And you get to have a long name and one of these things. And that's about it, actually. And I remember, as I said, I was feeling sort of quite happy and thinking, at last, I got my life on an even keel. And then I could feel this sort of, I'm going to ask for ordination. Go away. Like this urge to ask for ordination, which I knew would just make trouble again, if you see what I mean. It wasn't that I thought, oh yes, here's something I want to do. Like you might think of, I'd like to be promoted or something. Or you might think, here's a new career path I'd like to follow. It was more like, oh no, I'm going to do this, aren't I? Just as mean, how can I not do it? Let me just, hang on, there must be a way of not doing this. It was a very direct experience. I remember it very directly coming up and thinking, because I say, no, I'm not going to ask for ordination, I don't really feel it. And the more I was saying it, the more I was thinking, oh God, here it comes. I could feel this desire to ask. It was very frustrating. And sort of against my personality. I mean, personally, I don't know about you, but I just want to have a good time. I'm no more religious folks than that, I just want to have a good time. There was a song, wasn't it, called Girls Just Want to Have Fun. Well, yeah, I can relate to that. I didn't feel any more serious than that. I just want to have fun. I certainly didn't want to do things that would provoke difficulty, that would bring me onto a new level of something which I didn't really, obviously, I wanted. I just wanted to have a good time. The only trouble is, of course, that life won't allow it. Ordinary human life just won't allow that. Whether you want to have a good time, whether girls just want to have fun or not, life doesn't allow for that. Or rather it does, but not in the way you think, and only if you commit yourself to a spiritual life, really. You can't just extend fun, can you? Because life, as I've said in the seminar before, as we've explored earlier on, it ends with death, and you don't know when that end's going to be. So that's about as far away from fun as you could possibly get. The one thing that you definitely don't want to happen will happen, and you don't know when. That is the most serious human issue that we have. It creates a great problem at the centre of our life. And no, you can't just say, well, I'll have fun. It just doesn't work. Life asks something much, much deeper of us. So this asking for ordination is not to do with feeling that you're ready to be ordained, feeling that you know what it means, feeling that it would be good for you, feeling that here's a way that I can get somewhere in my life, here's a way that I can be accepted. I mean, actually, often what you find is when you ask for ordination, you have to work all that out after you've asked. You suddenly realise, for instance, how much of you are doing it to be accepted and liked and part of a group. Or you realise that, or you realise all sorts of things. You realise that you're not as nice as you thought you were, or that you're not as developed as you thought you were, or that you're more developed than you thought you were, and so on. You know. You don't know what you realise until you ask. But you ask because you ask, not because you think you're ready, not because you know what it is, but because something insists that you ask. As it were, from outside oneself almost, feels like you have to ask. And in a way, this is the theme of my seminar this evening, is this feeling of doing things that you can't think why you would do it. You just sort of feel compelled to. And that's certainly personally been my own experience, that, as I say, I never really wanted to practice a spiritual life. I don't think I'm a very spiritual or religious person in many ways. It's just that something wants me to. It's that life wants me to. I mean, you have to be very careful with that, don't you? Because before you know it, it sounds like God wants me to, or some outside force wants me to practice spiritual life against my will. And actually, it can feel like that. When I asked, it did feel almost against my will. But I don't take those experiences literally. But there is often in asking for ordination a sense of compulsion, a sense that I must commit to this. And it arises, and it makes you feel uncomfortable, like my experience, and you wish there was an easier way. You want to go back to girls just want to have fun. You want to go back to Cyndi Lauper, I think her name is. Those of you who remember. So you don't ask for a good reason. You don't ask because you're ready. You might even ask to find out if you're ready. You might even ask because you don't know. So I just wanted to correct that. Otherwise, from what I said last week, it could sound like, you know, once you're teetering on the edge of spiritual death, just before you drop into the abyss, you think, can I ask for ordination? And you fall headlong into enlightenment. So it's not like that, yeah. So yes, I want to try and talk about this. I don't know whether you have this, but I've had it, I think, all my life, this sense of something working its way through me, sometimes against my own wishes. Not literally, but that takes me to the question that asks more from me than I would otherwise have given. Analogously to how when I decided to commit myself to painting, much more was being asked of me than I'd meant to give to it. Much longer, much more hours, much more study, much more thought, much more struggle, much more mess. All that was being asked of me now, because now I'm going to take it seriously. It's as if painting then saying, okay, I'll take you seriously then. And interestingly, it often arises, so often it's helpful if you find an analogy. So one of the things that brought that arising to me, I'd been a nurse before then, was I went to Holland, and there was an exhibition of the Van Gogh Museum of Van Gogh's paintings. And they started right with the early paintings. You just walked up, went through the museum, and then right at the top were the last ones. I mean, there's only 10 years worth of painting. Incredible, when you think about it. And as I went on this exhibition, it just felt eventually that every single painting was saying, you do it, you do it, you do it, you do it. It was again that sense of being compelled. Look what you can do with paint. This is incredible. I was having a very, very strong response to the paintings at the time. And I would never have believed that just sort of coloured bits of mud basically on a flat surface could provoke in me such depth of feeling, you know. And it just seemed to say, this is the serious business of life. This is life. This is something worthwhile. This is something noble. This is something serious in the best sense. Live up to this. Respond to this. I think it is actually fully an analogy with spiritual life, because I think spiritual life is a continuation of respond to this. This is the serious thing to do with life. This is to do with you and relationship with life. Respond to this. This is what your life is for, if you see what I mean. The rest is just business. This is work. Artists often think of, I remember my old tutor, who was a wonderful woman, Alma Thurin, she used to say that her painting was her work and the rest of the thing for her job. And so her teaching at the Goldsmiths, where I was at the time, that was her job. But painting was the great work. That was the work. Yeah. So it's that sense of, here's my work. Here's my life's work. Yeah. And when you are receptive to that in others, it sort of rings something with you. It challenges you for your life's work. It challenges you to rise to your work. Yeah? And the highest understanding of that work is what we call, rather inadequately, the spiritual life. This commitment to what I'd like to call the journey of spiritual life is the great work. The great work. And sometimes when you start to get close to it, either in other people, sometimes it's to do with your contact with other people, that you see it in them. Just as you see Van Gogh's paintings. And sometimes you don't see it, do you? It's funny, I remember having this experience, in this case, in front of a painting by Cézanne. It was like, I can't explain it, it's incredible, I never had anything like it. And I noticed out of the corner of my eye, other people just walking past it. I just felt that you can't. I thought you can't just walk past it. You can't just walk. This is it. You know, you can't walk past it. Or they'd be listening on their doing things and sort of looking around. And it really wasn't. It wasn't that I was feeling critical. I was just in that moment suddenly in touch with the majesty of the work in front of me. And it just seemed amazing that other people couldn't see it. And it's that's, again, exactly analogous to spiritual life. When you start to see it in the figure of the Buddha, in reading a Dharma book, in a friend of yours who's in touch with it, in being on retreat, those are the classic places that you start to see spiritual life. You start to catch it. You can't believe that other people don't catch it. You can't. It's like, what have you not heard? So I remember on my first... I hadn't meant to say any of this. You know, I've actually got some notes tonight as well. Anyway, we'll hopefully get to them. On my first weekend retreat, 26 years ago, part of this retreat, we don't do it anymore, is we used to sit and listen to a taped lecture, we always call them taped lectures, by Bhante, by Sangharaja, the founder of this movement. And we were all sitting in this Nissan hut, which is very cold. I think it was in the afternoon. And then this very, very, he's got a very particular, Mr. Chairman and friends, he's got this very odd way of speaking, very slow, Mr. Chairman, and tonight. And it's very, and it's rather soporific, if you're not careful. And I sat there, this voice started, and gradually as the talk went on, people around me started to nod off. But again, it was that experience, I couldn't believe what I was hearing. I couldn't believe it. It was called Breaking Through to Buddhahood. I couldn't believe it. I just thought, how does this man know me so well? Not only know, he like has lived with me all this time and knows exactly what my life is really about. How does he know that? And how does he know exactly what I do and what I need to know? I mean, it was incredible. They say that the Dharma is of the nature of a personal invitation, which means that when you really hear the Dharma, it feels like you yourself are being talked to. It's not that a room full of people are being talked about. It's not some sort of abstract theory that's being talked about, but someone is talking directly to you. It's of the nature of a personal invitation. They're saying, yes, you, this is you, isn't it? That's your life, isn't it? That's what your life is about. Just see how you need to do this. It doesn't feel like a lecture to a group. It doesn't feel like a social theory, a political theory, any kind of theory. It's of the nature of a personal invitation. So as soon as you feel, how does this person know me so well? How have they understood me so well? In that moment, you're starting to hear the Dharma. Yeah? And again, when you hear the Dharma, when you see it, when you hear it, when you taste it, you can't understand that other people don't. You can come away from something thinking, oh my God, what do you think of that? And they say, yeah, it's alright. I was talking to somebody just the other day, and they were saying that she'd come along with her boyfriend, and he was very interested in it. And they both went to a talk. He said, yeah, it's alright. Yeah. And she was like, what? Alright, you know. That was something really important there. And you can sometimes not, you just think, but we're in the same talk. So it's not even just in the words. It's whether you get it or not. Sangharakshita Bhante says the Dharma is caught, not taught. Brilliant condensation of the Dharma, that it's caught, not that you have to catch it off people. Sometimes even a too scholastic, even a too Buddhist approach to it means you don't catch it. Sometimes some people are so worried about whether it's Buddhism, they don't actually catch it. They don't actually catch the Dharma. It's something you have to catch. And it's a spirit. You can feel it when you catch it. It's like catching flu. You see? More positive, but it is more positive. Sort of not entirely. It's not just up positive, not just bouncy, bouncy, girls just want to have fun positive. It's a sort of disturbing positive, an unsettling positive. But you definitely know, you feel you've caught it. It's quite palpable. Yeah. Anyway, I want to try and talk about those experiences where we feel we do something when we don't know quite why, even against our own instincts. Even when we don't want to, almost. And when we have a sense that we're seeing something and it's demanding something of our life, that there's within our life is a sort of demand, not an authority, not God saying you should do this, but a kind of experience demand. You see it sometimes in suffering, don't you, when someone is suffering around you and suddenly something is demanded of you. You have to respond. You have to live up to it. Yeah. Okay, so I've gone on much longer than I meant to about that. So what I want to try and do, just for a bit, if I can do it briefly, I'm not very good at doing things briefly, is just sort of step back and try and think of this a bit more metaphysically, which is not actually something I'm very good at, I don't think, but anyway, let's have a go. And then I'll come back to actually disagreeing with myself from last week and say this is also a stage that we can practice, suggest some ways in which we'll practice it. And then if I get time, I'll just finish with trying to again evoke something from my own experience, which sometimes, because it's my own experience, I can talk about it more from the inside, if you see me, rather than from the sort of theory, which I find I understand myself better. So let's just take a step back and try and look at human life from a metaphysical, philosophical point of view. So when the Buddha did this, when someone tries to... You can imagine it, can't you? People saying to the Buddha, yeah, but... So he'd mainly say, never mind all that, just kind of meditate. Here's the mindfulness of breathing. Do that for a bit. Come back and see how you got on. Tell you what, make friends. You know, you're a bit grumpy, frankly. make friends, do that for a bit, come back, see how you got on. You know what I mean? Tell you what, think a bit. Actually, start thinking, reflect a bit, and then when you've reflected a bit, come back and talk to me about it. You know, he was incredibly, seemed to have been incredibly pragmatic. He had what's called technically a metaphysical reticence. In other words, he was very unwilling to talk metaphysically. He seems to have been very unusual in that sense. In Indian religious and spiritual life, which was a sort of, there was a great kind of interest in that in the Buddha's day, there was masses of speculation. In fact, the Buddha, was sort of one of his epithets is he that doesn't speculate. He was very, very unwilling to speculate, to say, here's how the nature of reality is. I think he'd want to say, never mind all that, you'll only get it wrong. Let's actually change your mind, and then with a changed mind, you can see how reality is for yourself. That's what I did. How about you do that? Don't let's get into all theory about what things might be like. Yeah? He was metaphysically reticent. Sometimes he would just answer with silence. You know, someone would ask him about the nature of reality, and he'd just be silent. And it would be this incredible silence of no thought for the Buddha. So he'd just sit there, and as if it were, as if to say, here it is. You want to know what it's like? Here it is. You know, I mean, that's all that. I can't do it. I can't say anything, because as soon as I say something, I create misunderstandings. Here it is. You either get it or you don't. But you can imagine, can't you, there's some people thinking, no, I don't. No. Is he going to say anything? Do you see what I mean? Excuse me. Is that an answer? You know, you can imagine somebody at the back. So, you know, sometimes the Buddha would talk about the nature of reality. Okay, here we go. Let's talk about it like this. So his primary way of talking about it is in terms of what's called praticca samuppada. Some of you will know this already very well, but you can never think about this enough, because it's as close as we get in concept to a description of the nature of reality, which goes beyond concepts. So these are concepts to help us go beyond concepts. There is no conceptual way of describing reality. All you get in the net of concepts is concepts. That's all the net of concepts will catch, is concepts. You know what I mean? But this concept is as close to the nature of reality as you can get, in the sense of it's the least likely to be misunderstood, but still gets misunderstood. So praticca samuppada means something like conditioned co-arising, conditioned co-production. It's really important to remember that this is not a theory. It's not that the Buddha thought, let me think about it. Oh, yes, I got an idea. He's not thinking his way through, and he explicitly said it's not a theory. He said it's not hammered out with words. So the Buddha isn't like someone like Kant or Schopenhauer. He's not trying to come up with a theory for everything. He's a great thinker, without doubt, but he's not a theoretician. He's not a metaphysical teacher in that sense. He's not trying to come up with theories. Basically saying, I look around and this is what I see. Yeah? I see, praticca samuppada, I see that all things arise in dependence on conditions. That's what I see, that's what I observe. I've been thinking just recently, I was talking to Vidyadhara, and so much of spiritual life can be understood just in terms of observing. I'll come back to my point. But I've been thinking about it. That so much of spiritual life is really to do with observing, just being able to observe things. So I hope I won't embarrass you, but I noticed the other day, just as I came out, Diane, who's on the team, he was fluffing up the cushions on the sofa. You know, there's two sofas we've got. There's four cushions. And if you sit there for a long time, they get very scrunched into the corners. But if you're on the team, you've got various jobs. So you need to hoover, you need to wash up, you need to be on the door. And we always give out those jobs. So who's going to hoover, who's going to wash up? But who sees the cushions? Just a hint. Who sees the cushions? Such a small thing, but it's not a job. But as soon as you see it, it creates responsibility. Everyone's going to be rushing out there to film. You see what I mean? As soon as you see it, well, you've seen it. Now, often you don't see it. I mean, it's incredible what people don't see. But as soon as you see something, you now have a kind of responsibility. As soon as you see someone's upset, if you see it, you have a responsibility. If you don't feel that responsibility, you probably haven't seen it. Do you see what I mean? If you see, even it's even positive, if you see something beautiful, it sort of creates a responsibility. It means something about your life now, because look, beauty exists. If you see scrunched up pillows, you have a responsibility to do something about that or not. Do you see how that's why awareness is so absolutely central and crucial to spiritual life? Is basically who has the awareness of it. This is what you see with anyone that's more spiritually developed, is they just have more awareness in this sense. They see more things, literally see more things. And that's in every sphere of life. So there's a famous point with Bhante Sangharakshita where everyone who went to see him, this is many years ago now, Bhante would get the conversation round to how it would be good to have more Buddhist centres in the north of England. So, you know, you talk about art or poetry or your sister or how you feel or what a bad day you have. He said, oh yes, uh-huh. But wouldn't it be good to have more? Somehow, famously, wherever you started, he could end up with the north of England, and wouldn't it be good to have more? Yes, a lot of people suffer like that. And what I've been thinking is, wouldn't it be good? what's interesting about that for me is that it's just that he sees it. For him, his mind extends to the north of England. It's sort of a long way away. More recently, he'd been talking a bit similarly about Eastern Europe. Yes, but wouldn't it be good to have more Buddhist centres in Eastern Europe? Huh? Different way of speaking. I shouldn't do that on tape. Sorry. Any kidding? Okay. But what struck me about that is that, you know, I like to think of myself as someone that's committed myself to spiritual life. You know, and I'd like to see more Buddhist centres in these areas, but it doesn't show up to me very much. Sorry. Especially sorry if you come from Eastern Europe. It doesn't show up to me very much. Which basically means I don't see it. I don't really see it. Do you see what I mean? So much of spiritual life is just to do with whether you see things. And the Buddha is the person who saw most. He just looked around and said, actually, when I look at things, all I see is conditioned arising. That all things arise in dependence on conditions. That on the basis of this, that arises. On the ceasing of this, that ceases. That's what I see. When I look deeply enough, I just see that all things arise in dependence on conditions. Now, notice how metaphysically rigorous that is. So it's not saying anything about it. It's not saying why they arise, how they arise. Does, you know, when B arises out of A, did B pre-exist A? Is B somehow in A? Does B not exist in A? You know what I mean? If you follow the sort of philosophy of that. It doesn't say anything about that. The Buddha just says, on the basis of this, that arises. Have a look at that. Yeah. So in later Buddhist tradition, you then get an attempt to work this out. The Buddha himself just said, actually, to try and think of all the ways in that would happen is just too difficult. You can't think about that. A later Buddhist teacher, Gampopa, is it Gampopa? Buddha Gosha, sorry. Yeah. I thought that was wrong. Buddha Gosha has a go at saying, okay, here's five ways in which things are interrelated. Here's five ways and six in which one thing arises and depends on another. So let's just be really clear. What we mean by this, for Teacher Samyakpanda, is that reality seems to have a particular structure. It seems to be patterned in a certain sort of way. Teacher Samyakpanda is about discernible patterns of regularity, as the Buddha put it. Discernible patterns of regularity. It's a general principle of ordered relationships between conditions and their effects. It's a lovely, simple way of thinking about it. The general principle of ordered relationships between conditions and their effects. So it's saying that reality is patterned, that it has regularities built into it. So if I throw up an apple, it has a regularity that built into it that means that the apple will fall into my hand again, for instance, if you mean. I can believe that or not. I can have all kinds of theories about what makes it fall. I can decide that it bounces off the face of God and comes back into my hand. I can have all kinds of other theories. It's a tricky one, I know. It's very, very common in medieval novels. You know what I mean? I can have all sorts of theories. But actually, whatever I believe about it, that's a pattern of regularity you experience, on this earth at least. So he's saying that reality has in it regularities which you can understand, you can make use of. Patternings, yeah? And it's an observation. So Buddha Ghosha talks about five of them. He talks about Uttaniyama, they're called the Niyamas, or Niyamas as they're, I think, correctly pronounced. Uttaniyama, Bijaniyama, Manuniyama, Karmaniyama and Dharmaniyama. I want to mainly talk about the last two, and I'll try and be a bit briefer so I don't go on too long. So Uttaniyama is the physical inorganic. It's all those regularities that govern things like physics, chemistry. It includes things like gravity, thermodynamics, and so on. It's all those regularities of the physical, inorganic world. Gravity, for instance, that's why apples drop. Yeah? That if you look at life at that level, of the physical and inorganic, you find various laws, various regularities, various patternings, such as the law of gravity, the law of thermodynamics. Bijaniyama is a physical inorganic. So if you look at, the full organic, physical organic. Let's breathe. Keep your breathing space. Okay. Physical organic, yeah? So if you look at the physical organic aspect of life, it has, again, certain regularities, certain patternings. So this is includes the world of biology, botany, physiology, includes things like genetic inheritance. Physical organic has certain regularities in it. It's very striking, isn't it, with genetics. I saw my partner's a photograph of his mother holding her granddaughter, and they were looking up and smiling, and they look frighteningly similar. You know, it's like an invasion of the body snatchers. So there's two of them. But you can really see, you see it sometimes in gestures, in turns of phrase. The other day, I remember a while ago, I was on retreat and I coughed, and it was exactly my father's cough. I got to the age where I remember my father most, his marriage when I was a child. And my cough is now identical to my father's cough. Recently my brother was counting on his fingers. He was saying something to me and counting like that, you know, making a gesture going down the fingers. And that was what my father used to do. They think now that all these things, many of these things, are actually genetic. It's not just that you learn them, but you actually genetically inherit them. Yeah. So there are all kind of regularities built into this level of reality. Regularities that you can like or not like, agree with or not agree with, but they'll be there. They'll be affecting you. So whether I want to have my father's cough or not, there you go, I've got it. It's built into... It's actually, I probably presumably got exactly the same shape of throat as my father, interestingly. My hands, for instance, are almost identical to my father's. So that's there. Whether I like my father or not, whether I want to have his hands like his or not, there you go, I've got them. Then you've got the manoniyama, which is the psychological level of conditioning, but in the sense of things like reflexes and so on. Behavior. This includes all the things like behavioural science, such as behavioural science, like the fight and flight mechanism, that sort of thing. Your behaviour in that sort of way. So you could say that all of these three things are vital elements in our stage of integration. So when in the stage of integration, the first great spirit stage of spiritual life, you're getting to know those three niyamas as they exist in you, aren't you? So every time you come back to your body and your body's movements, you're coming back to uttanima, you're coming back to the bone, you're coming back to uttanima really and bijanima, you're coming to the physical, organic and inorganic, not sure about inorganic, never mind. You're coming back to your basic nature. It's more, even more important still in manonima, because every one of the things we're trying to do in integration is we're trying to learn, for instance, the kind of genetic loading we've got, the kind of person that the genetic pool has given me. My father's throat, but also my father's, I've also got my father's unwillingness to get angry, but also to think very, very critically, and sometimes unhelpfully so. So I can be like my father, I don't get angry very quickly, at least I don't express it, luckily for me as a child, but I'm like my father, I'm very critical. I didn't want to be, I didn't ask to be. I'd much rather really like to be a very good-natured person. I don't think I am that good-natured. Not naturally, not temperamentally. I'm quite a critical person. And my father was like that. And so on, yeah? So one of the things I was saying right at the beginning of this seminar was one of the weird things about life is that you're presented with a whole kind of set of structures and patternings that you never chose and which you don't even know about, which you have to discover. So you have to discover how much time you need alone. You have to discover whether you're a sporting type or not. And if you are, you need to spend more time doing physical activity, and if you don't, you get into a bad state. You have to discover all sorts of things about yourself. You have to discover your cultural background, for instance. What your cultural background has given you as a sort of personal trait. I was talking to Lawrence earlier on today, and again I was very struck by him coming from a very different culture than I do. And the mark that culture leaves on us. So I'm English, so as I said last a week or so ago, I have the English way of hatred, which is to be very polite and never mention how much I don't like someone. You know, it's the English way of hatred. But other countries just don't have that. They don't particularly do that. You know what I mean? It becomes a cliche, but the reason it becomes a cliche is because there's truth in it. It wouldn't become a cliche if there wasn't truth in it. Yeah? So we need to sort of discover our national characteristics and how that shaped our psyche. So all of that is integration. All of that is learning about the kind of creature we are. But then the next stage is moving on to the fourth aspect in which all things are patterned, are related. And that's karma nima. So this is where Buddhism starts to go beyond the sciences. What I think is fascinating about this, and I'm sure that Jan Vance will bring this into his day on What's the Matter, is that so often religion and science are put against each other, especially at the moment, and more recently, haven't there? There's been this argument between God and science, a new secularism, outspoken secularism, and a reaction to that. So often they're put against each other, but actually this model unifies them. It just says, okay, yeah, of course, if you look around, there are certain regularities in life, in the physical or inorganic, in the organic, and in this sort of instinctual psychological sense. But then the Buddha would say, yes, but there's another way, a higher way, in which things are interrelated, and that's to do with karma nirma. Karma, just, as I said before, just means action. And this patterning, this law, arises as self-consciousness arises. And self-consciousness only arises in us fleetingly. I think I said earlier on that it's a bit like a badly fitting light bulb. It flickers on and off. Sometimes it's on quite a lot, sometimes it's off quite a lot. In a way, this relates to this moment of observation. It's that moment of observation. Does consciousness emerge then, or not? Some people it doesn't. You can be standing in front of Cezanne, and you just think, yeah, nice one. Consciousness doesn't emerge. No, who's to say how that emerges, why that emerges? Again, the Buddha's not saying that. He's just saying, under certain conditions, self-consciousness emerges. Suddenly you're a truly subconscious subject. And as soon as that emerges, you enter this new structure of reality, which is that my actions start to have consequences which are appropriate to my actions. So I can start to choose how to act. On the basis of being integrated, and the basis of knowing myself, I can start to choose how to act. And that activates a new level of patterning in reality. So that if I'm kind, generous, wise, courageous, all the things that I've been saying in this stage of positive emotion, I experience a new kind of world. My experience comes back to me in a deepened, more aesthetic almost sense. You know, it's like when you're in a very positive state, it literally does feel as if the sun shines a bit brighter. People seem to smile at you more often. Things emerge that you hadn't thought of. Potentialities occur. Increasingly science is trying to catch up with this because, you know, one of the things they're realising is that when we're in a negative state, when we get into a sort of problem-solving state of mind, what's wrong with me, why aren't I happy, our mind narrows. And what it does, it narrows to fixate on the possible solution and to the point where you don't notice life, if you see what I mean. I'm fond of this, a little bit of research, but they did this research where they'd ask somebody a question, and as they were asking them a question, two people would go in front of them with a door, and the questioner would be replaced by another person, of a different gender, different clothes and so on. The first time they did the research, only 47% of people noticed. And the second time they did research, only 32% of people noticed. So there you go, you're asked a question, your mind locks onto, yes, how do I get to there? And you don't even notice that the person asking you the question is now a different person. You see, so as soon as you lock on like that, you edit out a lot of life. So when you're in a positive state of mind, you're in a more expansive state of mind. That's what positive means. That's the definition of it. You're in a more expansive state of mind. So you literally see more. You literally partake of life more. You see that there's much more to life than you thought. When you're in a negative state of mind, it's often to do with that kind of locked-on pejorative problem-solving mode. I don't mean it in the positive sense, which can be extremely elevated. But often, in science, it's true, isn't it, that it's that famous eureka moment where you're thinking, but because your thinking is also locking on and narrowing, it's often you do the great bit of thinking. I find when I go to the loo, I've been trying to write something, and I think, and I go to the loo, and just because I've relaxed a bit and broadened out, I suddenly wouldn't think what I'm trying to say. You know, you need that breath to come in. Often you need the both. You need to be able to, in positive problem solving, I don't mean this sort of awful automatic problem solving, which is about problem solving our own unhappiness, which is nearly always counterproductive. In this genuine problem solving, you need the concentration and memory expansion. So all that is to do with karma nirma processes. It's all to do with positive emotion, the stage of positive emotion, or kusala karma. We're trying to activate that structuring in reality. And you can like it or not, believe in it or not, agree with it or not, but it's just like apples falling, it's just there. It's just like the shape of your throat, it's just there. So if you act generously, you create a life out of generosity. Whether you believe it or not, whether you like it or not, tough. If you act hatefully, whether you believe it or not, whether you think you're all fair enough to feel like that, whether you feel whatever you feel, you create a world that comes out of hatred. That's how it is. That's what the Buddha's saying. You're saying, there you go. It's the law. It's how things are. Yeah. But what's interesting is that you then have this other structuring, the Dharma Nirma structuring. Dharma Nirma processes, because it's not a thing. So Dharma Nirma processes are saying, the most difficult process to talk about, because we can't talk about them really. What I want to say is they're a reflection of a reflection of that moment where, when I was talking to my friend, I can remember it. I was standing by some reeds near Padmaloka Retreat Centre. I was on a men's event. I was telling my friend, no, I'm not going to ask for ordination. and something in me was saying, I'm going to now ask for ordination. And it wasn't what I wanted, it wasn't me, it wasn't... It's difficult to describe, but it was, oh gosh, even though God, that's what I'm going to do. I don't know why, but that's what I'm going to do. Just as... Well, that's a good... It's that feeling of seeing. It's that feeling of, oh, crumbs, that's the truth. Someone was saying to me earlier on in the seminar that I said something that made them really angry. And she said it was really great because I got really angry because it was just true. I just thought, oh, yes, that's the truth, isn't it? I wish it wasn't. And it made her really angry, and she thought, that's great. And I thought, that's great. I mean, it's that, oh, crumbs. It's that, that's it, isn't it? It's when you see it in somebody else. It's when you know it. And even though you don't want to know it. And it feels like it's not quite you. It's not what you would have wanted, because girls just want to have fun. That's all you meant. And, you know, consciously, that's still mostly what I mean. I remember when I got a phone call from Subhuti saying, yeah, we're going to ordain you. I thought, I'd say, oh, right, don't take me so seriously. Yeah, I was only joking. Actually, my first response was, God, have mercy upon us, Christ, have mercy upon us. May the judgment not be too heavy upon us. Which is a bit odd, so I'm not even a Catholic. I wasn't even a Catholic. But that was my immediate response. God, have mercy upon us, Christ, have mercy upon us. May the judgment not be too heavy upon us. Just to confuse us all. But I still think, actually, there was something in that response I really meant. That, oh, now look what you've done. Now look what you've done. I could have felt it when I'd really understood that yeah, now I was going to paint. God have mercy upon us. Christ have mercy upon us. May the judgment not be too heavy. Oh no, more, I'm going to now be doing this serious thing called life. I'm now taking life seriously. And that's going to bring with it all sorts of challenges, all sorts of struggles, all sorts of discoveries. But I'm going to be living, and I'm a bit frightened of living. I wanted something more comfortable. The trouble is I can't have something more comfortable because look where it ends. But let's not think about that. Because so much of our life is, tell you what, let's not think about that. Let's just have a good time here. But we can't quite do it, can we? We can't quite say, let's not think about that. Somehow it keeps on casting its shadow in our life. So this domino of processes is this sense of something in the room almost. This sense of being touched by, as it were, a spirit that goes beyond us. A super-personal force, as Bhante calls it. A spirit that goes beyond us. The poet, Oliver Stevens, says, attuned beyond us and yet ourselves, as things exactly as they are. So it's attuned beyond us. It sort of wakes us up. But it's not us, and it can't be willed. You have to catch it. That's really what Sangharaksha is saying. You have to catch it. But sometimes you catch it. Sometimes it's there. There is in you, and yet it's more than you. It's not part of your egoistic willing. There's a structure in the universe which goes beyond you, and yet you're contained in it. You're contained in it. So I'll perhaps just finish now with just saying briefly my strongest experience, direct experience of that, just to bring us back to experience, and then we'll have a short break, and if you'd like to stay for a short puja to mark the full moon, you're very welcome to. If not, we'll just leave. Perhaps we'll leave again in silence in this room, and then if you want to stay for the puja, just stay on. If you want to go and get yourself a drink, go to the loo, just do that, and then just come back for the puja. We'll start again in a few minutes' time. So my little experience of this, and it was an experience, and I've told about it before, and it opened and it closed, and I'm not saying any more than that, but it was direct, so I definitely know it, even now, isn't it? So it's to do with I was being ordained 22 years ago. It was in the middle of a four-month retreat. The longest I'd ever been on retreat at that time, I was 29. And in the middle, we were you're ordained privately first, so it's just you and your private preceptor. They give you your name, for instance, and your name represents you when you're enlightened. So that when I'm enlightened, I really will be Maitreya Bandhu. Until then, it's a practice of trying to be Maitreya Bandhu. Maitreya means the kindly one, Bandhu means friend. So it means the friend of friendship. It's someone who's constantly, always a friend. One day, if I'm lucky, one day if I practice hard enough, whenever I'll be the Buddha Maitreya Bandhu. That's what your name means. Yeah. So you're given your name. And after the ceremony, I'd written this puja, that I'd written my own puja to mark my ordination, to try and get as much from the ordained as possible. I wanted to make sure it wasn't just a bright idea. I remember being struck the night before my ordination, that I was sort of saying to my mind, we're going to get ordained tomorrow. And it was just like people just chatting, whatever. My mind just seemed like two people just chatting on a sofa, smoking and drinking and gossiping, you know. And I was saying, excuse me, something like really important is going to happen. Nobody seemed to be taking any notice. So I wrote this puja to try and get as much of the ordained as possible. And then, anyway, I did this puja after my ordination. And I seemed to, for a moment out of time, I seemed to see things as they were. I seemed to see things how they were. You can't say anything about it because it's beyond language, but for a moment, the universe sort of opened up, and it was absolutely perfect. There was nothing wrong with anything, and there never had been anything wrong with anything, and there never could be anything wrong with anything. There was just this incredible thing. It was like my whole life I'd been staring at this funny bit of stitchwork and trying to work out what it was, and did I like it, and did I want it, and was it, how could I improve it, and suddenly I saw the whole tapestry. This is me. And it included that stitchwork. But it was part of that, the whole sort of tapestry. My immediate vision for it was a very simple one, which was that I'd been looking down the wrong end of the telescope all my life. And that suddenly, Sunderland had just come up and just turned it round. And you just think, it's just like that. I've got it all wrong. I've got the whole thing wrong. Not just the bad bits wrong. I've got the whole thing wrong. I'd just misseen it. I'd misperceived. Everything I thought was real, it wasn't like that at all. I'd been reading a story and I got all frightened by the frightening bits and all kind of moved by the moving bits and all angry at the angry bits and happy in the happy bits. But suddenly it was just a story. It was just a story. It hadn't been like that at all. Yeah? And then the experience just sort of closed. But for that moment it was just, ineluctably, it was nothing to do with, I didn't think, it wasn't hammered out with thought, it was just a sort of pre-seeing of how things are. So I want to just leave us with that, not because of anything special about that experience. I think a lot of people have those kind of experiences or tastes of those experiences, but just to come back to the fact that it's an experience, not a view. Because when you get five things and you can talk about them in this way, it can start to sound like reality is a sort of structure, a machine that you can work out with your mind. All of those words, all of those concepts are trying to point you to something, are trying to point me to something. Just as when I was looking at that Van Gogh painting when I was in my early 20s, it was trying to say, this you can do with life, more life, this is more life, here it is just now, more life, this is life, this is the serious life to live, and you know it is. You know darn well it is. So how are you going to respond to that? Okay, so let's leave it there for this evening. If you'd like to stay for a short puja, you're very welcome to. If not, let's just sort of leave in silence.